I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Brad Rimmer. Hello, Brad.
G'day, Michael. Nice to see you and meet you finally.
Well, it is, isn't it? Two Wheatbelt boys.
True, yeah.
I claim training as my spiritual home, Brad. What about you?
Well, yeah, Wiley, Wildcatcher, just down the road. But, I had quite an association growing up with training.
They're interesting places for those of us who grew up there. They change, you go back, you discover things have disappeared. What's your experience?
Well, definitely. I guess from photographing the places, you tend to notice things. And within a couple of generations, how quickly the towns have changed. The economies of farming have changed, and that has a general effect on the small communities and how they've changed as well. So it's been quite dramatic. That change from what you would have known as a small boy to my time as a small boy in the 70s, how quickly things have changed.
I lived in the town. So many of the kids I went to school with and round about were on the land. Even then, the farms are still there. Some of them have probably got a lot bigger.
There'd be names that we both know, for sure, who have been farming for several generations around training. Even then, you're right, a lot of them, there was quite a shift during the 70s. A lot of people did decide to leave, and the farms, that's when the farms started getting bigger. But there'll still be those main names, and some we've already spoken about earlier, people that we both know.
My father was the headmaster of the training primary school, but really he wanted to be like his father and his grandfather. He wanted to be an artist, a painter, and he started painting. And I showed you a painting a bit earlier. There weren't many trees left around Wiley and training in the central wheat belt in those days, Brad.
Well, no, it was cleared very quickly, which is an interesting thing to talk about, and another aspect to do the environmental consequences of that dramatic clearing that took place very quickly. I don't think a lot of people were aware of the consequences at the time, because it was the promised food bowl of the nation, the wheat belt, and that expansion that took place after the First World War, and grants that were given out to a lot of people who weren't necessarily farmers, who took it on, and it was a huge thing. And psychologically and physically, I mean, it was unbelievable what some of these people did. And
my other memory is that most people got involved in sport in one way or the other. They played, if they were boys, footy and cricket. If they were girls, they played hockey and netball. We all had the school athletic carnivals. The parents, as they got older, started playing bowls. And of course, there was golf and tennis, and everything was happening really in these towns.
A good golfer from your Beanie.
Very good golfer from the old Beanie.
Terry Gale.
I've got a wonderful photo of Terry and my father together. Yes.
We tend to cling on to anybody who becomes famous.
Oh, exactly.
There's even talk that in Wildcatcher, a secretary to the Queen, I can't remember his name or the time he was her secretary, but was born from Wildcatcher and came from Cowcowing.
Well.
So, I mean.
You can't get any higher than that, Brent.
No, we try. We've tried very hard. But the sport thing's really interesting because you're right. Every small town had a football team, at least one. And since I've been going back and doing this work, Wildcatcher had just one grade football team. They used to have two. Now they don't have any at all. They've amalgamated with Darren. And in the early days, we used to play in the Central Wheat Belt League, which included towns, which was training it would have been
Cunnanoppen
and probably Yalbini.
Yes.
And they were always quite a powerful teams. And Mark and Burton and Ben Cudden and Beacon and things like that, and Quarter. So yes, all those towns were very proud about their sporting heritage.
These towns, as you say, given some of their history after the First War, soldier settlement, people who really didn't know how to farm or learning how to farm, and some of them turned out to be pretty good farmers. But then there's the whole question of infrastructure. There was once a railway line, of course, that came from Northam on this more northern loop through to Meriden. I don't think it's there anymore, is it?
It's still there, but it's just overgrown with weeds.
A photographer's delight.
Well, it's actually, it just seems like it's almost like, just to remind everybody what was there. And we're talking about a particular character up there who created his own tavern. And Larry, he decided that he would build a train that would go on wheels, and then you could sort of lift it up and then drive it to the railway line, and then put it down so you could go up and down the railway line and maybe take people on a bit of a tourist trip up down to sort of come knocking them back. But then he got in trouble with CBH, I think, because they owned the line, and the police and a few other things. Meantime, he had this well-equipped train that could carry some people. That was a bit of a laugh, but it just seemed like how ridiculous to ban something that could actually be enjoyable for somebody to do on this weed-ridden sort of railway line that's been left unused.
Well, the infrastructure came. If you lived in the central work belt, you knew where I did. You knew that Cunno had the hospital and the doctor. Mm.
Dr. John.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Nungarran had the army base, and they had the swimming pool, and they had the best potato chips you could get this side of Kentucky or somewhere. Training, though, had a West Farmers store on the main drag, which was quite good. And the McEwans had another little store. But right next to the McEwans, pretty much, was the Shire offices and the training town hall.
Okay.
But all of these places have town halls, Brad, most of them.
They do. And in fact, when I did my first book, Silence, I photographed a couple of halls. One of them was the the Tammany Hall, and then also photographed the Doodlekind Hall. And I thought, I only used one in the book, but it was something about that almost kicked off this interest about these places, because suddenly I realised that every time I was going back over the years, the ones that I thought would be there to photograph are gone. So that's how that book came about. Nowhere Near was, I thought, well, I should get out and actually just photograph as many as I can, because
they're disappearing.
They're disappearing.
It's not the only part of Australia, I suppose, where you can be driving through a place which appears on a map, almost a sighting, but there's often a hall of some description right there.
Or the cleared land where there would have been a school, a hall, and possibly an original silo wheat bin, which would have been the old sort of corrugated ones, which were too small now, so they just would have cleared it. It would have been a general store. I mean, that was quite common. I can name just around that district we're talking about several that have basically, there's just vanished. Should be, there might be a stone plaque or something just to remind people that once upon a time there was a primary school here and whatever.
The other interesting thing is the point you made about the fellow goes off to become the Queen's private secretary or whatever, is that kids, you, me, we all grow up in these places and go off. We don't all become farmers. We don't stay in businesses in the town. Some do. But you become a photographer. Now, tell our listeners how it was you became so engrossed that it became your life.
I don't know. I became fascinated in it quite early, and I was always interested about drawing and things as a kid. My grandfather, who unfortunately passed away when I was probably about 12, he had Parkinson's disease, so I just remember him as this kind of frail man shaking. But he had a real passion for photography and had a darkroom, but he used to document things around town, social things, as well as he also had a fascination about music. And I remember in the house, my grandparents' house, there was probably, would have been about five or six gramophone record players, an incredible collection of music, and there was always music being played. He played the piano accordion and started a band, which my father played sax in. So in the 50s, there was this small band that used to do, like so many small bands in those areas, playing every Saturday night in some small community hall. So he was obviously interested about something to do with the creative side, though he had a mechanical business. So maybe something in genetics, I'm not sure. Unfortunately, he was never around to see when I started doing things, because it would have been lovely to have been able to sort of go through and show him what I was up to.
So do you have the My First Brownie type story to get into this?
No, mine was an old field camera, 5x4. I didn't even know what they were, but I just remember, one of my earliest memories is in our back garden, looking at things upside down, back to front on ground glass screen, and this fascination about capturing something within a frame, I think, and it was almost magical. So when I first had got my hands on the Instamatic camera, I was always just photographing everything. And that, I think, encouraged me to sort of think that there's more beyond just how we see things in the visual context, but how you can sort of frame stuff and how you see the world through a camera is a totally different thing.
Well, you've had this wonderful, it's still up, isn't it, the exhibition up at Wallula Fremantle Arts Centre, capturing these town halls. And you've had Emily Barker, who's a wonderful musician and singer. And unfortunately, we can't claim each other as relatives, even though we would, if we could. Featuring in this, you've had a in some of the halls, it's a lovely exhibition and it's got a lovely name.
Well, Loom of the Land was named after a song by Nick Cave. That was used as an essay in my first book, Silence, by the curator based in London now, Susan Bright. And so she used that as a title for essay. And I had to come up with a name for the exhibition. And names are such an important thing, because once you've locked onto it, especially a book title, that's it. And I kind of like the name of Loom of the Land because it is, apart from the fact that the exhibition really can sit looking at it, an angle that looks kind of reasonably sort of, oh, that's lovely, but there's something else going on. That thing about Loom, of what it presents, uncertainty of things like that. And I think that whole, so that was very important about that title. Emily, do you want me to tell you a little quickly about Emily? I was introduced to Emily through somebody at the Arts Centre. I heard that she was originally a Bridgetown girl. So she was a country kid. She went to London for 22 years. She came back, now she's living in Fremantle. So for her, it was also about returning to a place and then re-seeing the landscape. I took her out to the town hall that she chose, North Bandy, and checked out the old piano. And then she wrote a piece of music in response to my photos, but also in response to the hall. And it was a beautiful response. The other one we did too. The other one was Mark Holsworth, who's a Fremantle composer. So he wrote a piece in response to the Eastern Wheat Belt, and that then I took him out to introduce him to Ben Cubbon Hall, and we found the old piano at the back of the hall, and I had footage of him testing what keys would work so he could then write a piece of music in response to that old piano, the place, the interior of the hall, and we got a grand piano up there so that he could actually play a piece of music that actually incorporated both pianos, the old and the new one. It's a very powerful piece of music.
Isn't it beautiful? Because people forget there was a whole life, social life, intellectual life, going on in these places. I'm fond of saying to people that lots of people around the world discovered Australia existed with the Sydney 2000 Olympics, this marvellous multicultural place. The place I grew up in, training, was absolutely all of that by 1960. We had Polish railway workers, the Pali Italians lived just across the road, we had Irish Catholics, we had everybody up and down and all around. So when people tell me Australia became multicultural, around about 2000, I get a bit impatient, Brad.
It's true, but when you're growing up as a kid, you just take it for granted. And I know even we were talking about the Polish family that I was very close to, I never really thought about until I was older about how difficult it must have been for the parents who came out after the Second World War. Just surviving on losing their things like food and culture and dance. Then I found out that at one of the at the mother's funeral that there was a whole Polish community around the wheat belt, and they would have these gatherings. I never knew about it at the time, and they would sing and dance and have Polish food. So all the stuff's going on, and half the time we're just living your life here, immune to sort of all these incredible things.
Well, we're going to get tearful in a minute, Brett.
Well, I mean, I find it quite emotional, and I, even when I talk about the pictures and particularly some of the portraits, there's always this background stuff behind and many layers to it.
Let's go to the first one you've picked to discuss with me and show to and describe to our listeners. So
that's Jess.
You call this one Jess.
That's Jess.
And where's this taken?
So this is taken in Wildcatcham in summer of 2005-06. And I had a little bit to do with Jess's father, not a huge amount, but he was quite a bit younger than me. So when I photographed Jess, I always have a series of pictures with me. So when I meet people just by random on the street, I will show them what I'm doing. So they're some kind of understanding, because it's hard to explain. So Jess decided she wanted to be photographed on that veranda at her auntie's house. And she really commanded the picture and how she stood. And she was very much about what that book was about that age group and making decisions about leaving and staying, that dynamic, which is really hard for country kids.
It's a big decision. We touched on it earlier. You're going from a country town where you sort of know everyone, they know you, you've got a comfort zone. But if you go to Perth, or you decide you want to go to Melbourne or somewhere, it's a big step.
Well, they tend to be, country kids tend to be adventurous a bit more because they've had to. Either due to circumstance, you've had to go away to boarding school, or you had to become independent very quickly. Yeah.
So what follows Jess?
So next to Jess would be Sharon.
I love this photo. I love the colours in it. I love that sky.
Yeah, I mean, what's good about talking about a picture like Sharon's, is like Sharon's photo took a good 6 months to happen.
Wow.
So I've been looking, because it was very Anglo-centric, the pictures, and I thought I really need to try and get some local Noongars involved. Then they're far more kind of cautious about what your intentions are, which is obvious. I was introduced to Sharon's grandmother, Charlotte, this incredible woman from Caliberran. We became actually very good friends, Charlotte and I. So it took a long time before I got the approval to say, okay, you can take Sharon's photo, because Sharon was 14 at the time and she was living with her grandmother. And I know the day when we finally went to take the photo, Charlotte said to Sharon, you cannot wear that top. I don't want you to wear that top. It's terrible. You've got to dress up for this. And Sharon said, well, if that's the case, I'm not going to do the photo. And I kind of intercepted and said, look, I think this top's great. Let's just go with it.
And this is the top.
This is the top.
It makes the photo too.
It does make the photo. And it's one of these beautiful situations, a bit like Jess. And in fact, most of the girls in the photos tend to photograph differently what the boys do. They're very confident. And when we're at the top of the hill on the edge of Caliberran that overlooks the town, that beautiful winter light. And I remember Sharon's quite short, so I was on my knees photographing up to give her a bit more elevation. And she just owned the photo. She just looks so beautiful. It's a beautiful photo.
It's totally a beautiful photo.
And her grandmother was behind complaining about the cold weather. If I get a cold. But anyway.
Caliberran, another lovely town. We'll get to some other nearby towns like Tammin and North Gardenway and so on.
Yeah.
So what have we got here?
So the next one is during the book. Sometimes I get bored in trying to find people to photograph, because a lot of them are very random pictures. I just come across people. And then I thought, I've always wanted to go in to see what the Tannen Town Hall looked like, because I drive past it all the time. I was bored one day and I went inside and I discovered this beautiful hall, this pale blue hall with this red Hessian curtain. And I thought, I should just photograph it while I'm here anyway. And I used it in the book, and that's what set off this interest about the interiors of the town halls. Not necessarily the exterior, but the interior, which was something which often was totally removed from what the exteriors of these places are like. It's almost like you're holding on to something from somewhere else, and you go into it and it has a sense of theatre, a sense of expectation, and almost a softness in the colour schemes that were so removed from the harsh exterior.
I want to meet the man or the woman who chose that big red.
It's beautiful.
Right, isn't it? Something.
Well, I went back and I re-photographed it in Nowhere Near in 2020, and they were about to paint the hall, and they painted it white, completely white everywhere. I think they got rid of the badminton court lines, and they put in very, very dark, dark curtains, which were sort of a deep red. And I remember saying to them in the shower, oh, that's a shame. You're going to change it. So I re-photographed it for the next book, so I've got a copy of it.
I guess it's progress.
It is progress.
Of some sort.
And you, I mean, it's their hall. And I think it gets used a bit. But there was something that just so beautiful about that red curtain.
So thank you, Tamman. Do we have some sense of when that town hall was built?
No, but a lot of them would have been around in the 20s, I guess. And another thing about those town halls, as I discovered going around from all the way from Geraldton all the way around towards sort of Ravensthorpe, Esperance direction, pretty much photographed everything I could in halls, is that depending on the status of the town, you could see that by the architecture of the hall and the size of it. So it was a bit of a way of showcasing the local district's wealth and status. So they're quite competitive, these towns, as you know from your time growing up. So some of them were built by well-known architects. Then you'll get the opposite, which would be this very humble little hall out in the middle of nowhere, a community hall like North Bandy.
It's something. I mean, places like Tamman were on the run from Kalgoorlie and Southern Cross to Perth.
Yeah.
And owe themselves in many ways, initially, to the gold rush.
True.
But then the farming, of course, that you've already described, and the railway goes through and still does. So what do we have next?
The next one is Katie.
So Katie has a really querulous look about her.
She does. There's quite a bit behind Katie. So she's in Tamman. The location was interesting because behind me to her left, I had met this family who introduced me to their son Jordan and his friend Sam that I photographed at the end of the street. And when I was photographing those two boys, Katie was a friend, she was hanging around. And I kept thinking, I'd love to photograph Katie. She was 14. So I gave her the note to fill in. She took home, her mother filled in. So the next trip we'd organise, I could photograph Katie. So she had time to think about it. She'd seen me photograph the boys. So she'd done a bit of makeup and prepared herself for it. But still, it's a photograph that's, she always gives this impression she's not quite sure. And I don't know her circumstances at the time, and I don't want to kind of try and guess on that either. It can be quite dangerous when you start doing that. But 17 years later, this was 2009, 17 years later, when we were deciding on the layout of that sequence of pictures in the main room of the gallery, the 42 pictures we put up of silence, we were playing around with the photographs and got a message, and it was from Katie. She'd been contacted via the local shire in Tamman, and she contacted me to say that she was so excited to hear from me. She's now in her early 30s. She has 5 children, running a very successful business in the wheat belt, lives in 2J on 124 acres or something. And she kind of gave these photos a sense of not only were they important for their time, but they also have an historical context now of where these people are in their lives and that time where they were back in 2005 and 2009.
It really is lovely. And again, the colour. I mean, she knew what she was doing. That lovely, colourful jacket, shirt she's got on.
Because I did say it would be really lovely to catch her and re-photograph her in the same location now. And yes. Even her friends, Jordan and Sam. And Sam had been in contact with me. I guess just going back just quickly, when I photographed Jess, I had some issues with these photos with her dad for reasons, which I really can't go into, but he wasn't happy. He wanted the film from the photographs. And so I handed over, I left some film at my sister's farm at the time for him to collect. I was using 2 cameras and I didn't realise, I gave up on the project because I thought it was just too difficult. It was getting too dangerous. There was things to do with this photograph that really got out of hand. And so I gave up on the project. And then I was told about a fellowship that the Department of Culture and the Arts were doing for a short period of years. And somebody said, you should really apply for this and try and get the money to do a book out of it. So I thought, okay, 2009, I needed to go out and do more photos. I realised that I hadn't used these 2 cameras because they were my travel cameras. And the second camera still had some film in it. So I got a process, and there was 2 shots of Jess that I must have taken after I finished the first roll of film. And one had her eyes open, one had her eyes shut, and I thought, well, this has got to be the cover. So she became the cover, and her dad made out that he was behind the whole thing and it was his idea. But anyway.
It's an interesting question. I've had this discussion with serious photographers like you before about people.
Mm.
Are there rules around this? I mean, obviously you've got parental consent for younger people and the like. Is it, how's it work?
Yes. This one, on this occasion, I'd been in the hotel that afternoon waiting for the sun to go down so the light was better. So I knew some of the people in the pub and he was there, the dad. So I presumed that it was cool, it was okay, that I'll sort it out later on after I'd taken the photograph. Because I just found her on the street when I was driving past and asked if I could take a photograph.
Mm.
Which in hindsight, really I should have got permission first.
Mm.
And that's where it all went to.
Got complicated, but it worked out well in the end.
It did, but it got very messy. And luckily, my old grade 3 school teacher, who became the principal of the Wildcatcher school, well, she was the sort of lady didn't mess around with. I spoke to her, I said, look, I really need some intervention here because I want to continue the project, I want to use this picture. And she said, I'll sort it out. So she intervened and spoke to him, and then it was all sorted out. So I owe her a lot. And I still call her Miss Bruce, even though her name's Sue. Because she was incredible...
She was Miss Bruce.
She was. She was...
So what are we looking at next?
So after Katie, then we go to the Darren drive-in.
Now, there are not many drive-ins left. I can tell you in training in my day...
I remember that drive-in.
About 1960-61, there was outdoor pictures at the back of the town hall. They also did show them inside.
Yeah.
But outside... Like this. Amazing. How did Darren get into the business? Very prosperous town, of course.
Well, every town had a drive-in theatre. This one, for some reason, they've kept the screen even though the drive-in's not operating anymore. This photo kind of summarises that kind of situation, which is why it's such an interesting picture, because suddenly you've got this relic of a car sitting in front of the screen and the twilight with the... It's a beautiful picture when it comes to the light. And I think this also sums up a lot about how time has changed. So that's why the significance of this picture is quite a good one. And it's been used quite a bit around the place.
It's a lovely one. It sparks all of those conversations, doesn't it? Not just in relation to country towns, about what happened.
Well, again, the generational thing with technology, how suddenly television takes over. And then from television, things have changed. And we think it's great, but often sometimes you're losing something. And I think this represents that.
Something that you've lost. Mm. And then after Darren?
Then we go to one of my nephews, Daniel, who was in the back of a ute. Daniel was a champion shooter and was competing. And I think he had potential to do very well. But being in a small country town, my sister, I remember once, she had to drive him across the Nullarbor to compete in a championship. I think the two boys did very well. I'm not competing against adults, and they're only probably about 15 or 16 at the time. But Daniel, I was lucky enough that I could always lop onto my sister's farm near Darren, and there was always action happening around the place with the boys. So I was introduced to other things going on, there was always an interesting opportunity. This one's just one of those photos that it has a certain dynamic.
It absolutely does. What catches me is the eye that you can't quite see and the way it's looking off straight down that sort of furrow pattern.
Yeah. And also, I'm shooting on the cameras I'm using for that first book. You can see it's a square format, 6x6, so I'm using a rangefinder, which I'm not very good at focusing quickly with, so sometimes there's a bit of luck about making sure you've got the focus where you want it to be.
You were pleased with the outcome.
I'm always pleased when it works, because a lot of the time it doesn't. Anyway, and later on we'll see a picture of Daniel's daughter, who I put in, who's in the next generation. So, Daniel at the time, he would have been probably about 20, 21.
Yeah. Well, it's lovely. It's got a nice sort of ordinary daytime colour to it all.
There's quite a bit behind it, which I probably can't go into. But, and it's... it's interesting. As soon as you have anything to do with a gun in the picture, there's all sorts of connotations that people can read into it. So
Well, yeah. Just assume he was rabbit shooting, but...
Not during the day, but anyway...
No, exactly. But
it's still, it's a strong photo.
It is, and it makes you ask all those questions.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to... Depends where you put the photos in the book and sequencing and how things relate to each other. What sits next to those pictures can inform you as well or create its own narrative. So this was something very new about making a book, was that whole thing about suddenly how you do see pictures when you photograph and thinking about how you're going to place it in the future.
And then they're all juxtaposed.
Yeah.
And what's the next juxtaposition?
So the next one's an interesting one. So this was...
Amazing photo, really.
In 2009. It was Easter, Good Friday. I'd read about the Anglican minister, Barrett, I can't remember her name, Kathy Barrett Leonard. She had returned from living overseas for quite a while and became a priest, went back to where she grew up in Wongan Hills, and she was the priest of the Anglican church there. And she decided for Good Friday, let's do some kind of celebration. And with some local farmers, they set up a cross with hay bales. And I think the length of it was something like 2 kilometres by 1.5 kilometres or something. It was quite big. So I'm up on the only hill. I had to climb up to be ready for this film, to film the cross when it was lit up. So it was this incredible, and it was moonlight, so there's a bit of light in the sky as well. So
it is arresting. You just want to know what it is. And then you realise, yes, there's a cross. It isn't that lightning struck in that pattern formation.
No, and it's, yeah, and it's quite a significant picture within the body of work as well, what it represents, what it's about. I know American people have seen it, found it quite uncomfortable about this picture for reasons, depending where they're from in America. Burning of crosses, you know.
Yes, there are places you can't do it, but then there are...
Yeah, so I have to always explain. But it was, she had people who came from all over the state for this gathering.
Oh, I bet they did.
And I think they only did it once, but it was really something quite special. So.
And what have we got here?
So when we do divert into the next book, so I did 3 books on the Wheat Belt. Silence, the first one with the square pictures that you've seen. The next one was Nature Boy. So Nature Boy was something I wanted to continue on from where I felt that Silence needed it a bit more. So I wrote short stories for this book over 1 year of a period in my life when I left high school and why I worked on the wheat bins for a year before I came to the city. So... this is an interesting picture because it's out of focus. But when you look at it closely, you suddenly realise that it's the windscreen of the car that's in focus with the bugs.
Yes.
Yeah. But I also liked it because I've driven down this road near Ben Cabin and there was something about these trees I really loved. And taking it out of focus turns into almost like a painterly quality to it. So there was this kind of almost like 2 things happening at once. But when I took the photo, being the only person on the road, I had to sit in the back seat of my car with my tripod legs spread out across the top of the front seats to try and get the camera in a position that was comfortable so I could take this photo. And one car would drive past, this old farmer in his Ute, slowed down, wound down his window just to say, you okay? And then he just saw me sitting in the back seat with his camera between my legs and just wound up the window and took off.
Not surprised.
Yeah. So I hope he's come to the exhibition.
It is interesting because it took me a while to realise it was out of focus and it wasn't me.
No. So the next one is...
This one is interesting.
So this one's of one of the only people that wasn't a local that I photographed, but he's... Father was one of my closest friends, and they lived out in Cowcowing. And this is his son, Lachlan, who looks just like his father did at the same age. So there was this resemblance which was uncanny. So I put Lachlan to the scene that I've been wanting to photograph for a while. It has a bit of a relationship to one of the short stories, but there was something about having this, and he was this kind of... has the physique that suited the landscape with these couple of trees.
It's a bit Drysdale-ish, isn't it?
Yeah. And I used... So his father had his foot on the brake lights of my car so I could have the red glow.
Well, how clever is that? I'd wondered whether you had an infrared light or just what.
No, and it had been an image that had been in my head for a long time of wanting to try and produce, because normally I've come across things and just photograph them as they are. So Lachlan was freezing cold. It was a cold day.
But I'm taking it that he was happy to in that muscular way.
He was. There's another photo of him in the exhibition as well. We're standing in front of the driveway of his parents' farm. And
yes.
He came to have a look at the exhibition a couple of days ago, and the staff just went, Lachlan. I pointed him out. They recognised him. Yeah. So the next one.
Well, this is interesting. This is as though,
Okay, well.
I just love the colours of it.
Well, absolutely, and it was all about the colour.
Well, it could be Paris, Texas.
It could have been. Could have been anywhere, but it wasn't Paris, Texas. But yes, I'm sure that Wim Wenders would sort of love this picture. But it's a bit of a quirky story. That's the Quarter Hotel.
Good old Quarter.
A friend of mine who helps me quite a bit when I'm out, he lives still farms in Kaukau in LB Holsworth. So he's an old farming family. He would, if I'm going to be around, would say, well, let's meet at the Quarter Hotel for lunch or for dinner. And I had a friend, Patrick Brown, who's a great photojournalist who now lives in Copenhagen. He was back in Perth at the time. So he came out with me. We ended up at Quarter, and it was a Friday night, and it was the night where they would do the Chase the Ace, which is a game that the jackpot builds up over time until somebody actually draws the Ace of Spades.
And you win the room.
And anyway, there was probably about 20 people in the hotel all hoping to win the jackpot, which was just over $600.
Mm.
And I jokingly I was lucky enough to get the ticket to draw the card, and I drew the Ace of Spades and won the $600, which then supplied the rest of the people in the hotel drinking to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And in the morning when I woke up, I looked across the room, I could see this door ajar, and there was this beautiful glow coming out of the door. When I opened it up, it was just at this time when the light was right, so I raced down, grabbed my camera. Because it changed within a few minutes. It had gone.
It really is something. I love those sort of photos. I mean, real life, but, you know, turned into gold.
It did, and it's been interesting because it's been acquired by a couple of private collectors. And
oh, good. I love those sort of photographs. I mean, they're true art. You want it. Just look at it and think, what's going on here?
Considering where my head was that morning, how I managed to actually... Because I know Patrick, he woke up and came out of the next room and looked at me and thought, what are you doing? And then he looked in the door and thought, oh my God, look at that. And my friend Elby then came down the corridor with a splitting headache saying, what are you up to? You're trying to make more money out of this place. Because he can't quite understand how I'm selling photos. And I said, well, look at that. And he thought, oh, yeah, that's quite remarkable, but unremarkable.
Photographers talk about the money shot. This is the $600 shot.
Anyway, it was. But
so we go from the glowing bedroom
to Ricky.
And she's so pensive.
She's beautiful. I met her when I went into the Tamman pub because I thought I'd like to photograph the interior when I was doing Nature Boy. And she was standing behind the bar, and mid-afternoon, nobody else there. And I thought, okay, she's pretty amazing. She'd be great to do a portrait of. So I showed her the book Silence I had with me and said, look, I'm doing this new book. Would you be interested in doing a portrait? She said, yeah, no problem. I said, the only thing is, could we do it in one of the little motel suites next door to the pub? Do you mind? She said, oh, it sounds a bit weird. So I kind of explained.
It does sound a bit weird.
It does, right? You know, a guy in his mid-50s. Then I explained what it was about a little bit, and she said, no, that's fine. And so I took many photos of her because it was quite a tight space, but she was just magnificent.
It is. There's something about it. I mean, the way her hair's assembled, the brown room for a change.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it just worked beautifully. Sometimes things just work. And she's... Recently, I've managed to find out how I can contact her, so I'd like her to come down and see the show.
Because
I did pass on a print. I left at the hotel the next time I went up there, but they said she left, so I'm not sure if she got it or not. So
now this could be a still for Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, but it's Boora Lamming, which is between Darren, Wildcatcham and Cordis in this back road. They used to have a football team too once upon a time.
I can hardly believe it.
Anyway, part of not repeating what I'd already done in the first book, I wanted to make sure that I also looked at the landscape in a different way and gave it a different kind of the way that you'd see it wasn't always just the same. And there was something about, I have triggers with colour. And so I decided, well, I also had a pet crow as a kid. And so I had this thing about crows. And then also there's this another layer about how crow's nests represent something in dead trees, because the crow won't return to a dead tree for its nest. They'll use the same nest over and over every year, but not one when the tree's dead. I mean, they'll go to a better piece of real estate. They're pretty clever. So also that represents things to do with the landscape, many other kind of metaphors that are involved around it. So, but this colour particular was this trigger that I was trying to replicate in my grandmother's biscuit tin or cake tin. When you opened it up, it had that beautiful kind of coppery gold colour. So I'd see colours and they would trigger a memory. So I was trying to incorporate that in the series I did with these crow's nests.
Well, it's worked. And I've had a theory that I've wanted to turn into law for a long time, and that is that kids, before they turn 10, living in cities, should have to go and spend time in the country so they can see skies like this at night or the sort of images you've got. They learn about a lot more than they do if they just stay in the city.
So the next one was the blue tree. Another, this one is particularly one I really love, and I got the colour right on this because I couldn't just...
Well, you think you're in the Antarctic or something.
Well, there was something about how colour, how it affects you emotionally when you see something. So that this one is to do with a lolly wrapper when I was a child. So there was, I can see colours within the space that will take me somewhere straight away to a thing and a smell and taste. And we all have these triggers. So this was very much about that. And the skeleton trees have a particular feel in the book as well. You'll see that when you look through it, where it sits and how they actually change your whole emotional sort of reaction with the place. In the exhibition, we deliberately used that hallway and painted it a dark grey so that it became very theatrical when you entered that space.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally removed from the other pictures.
Yes. No, you do. I can remember thinking, where was I going?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is not just a sort of a drive down memory lane. It's just beautiful photography. And this is like the ultimate bent over old bloke who's probably just...
Given up.
Given up.
Well, those trees are interesting anyway, because they do tend to, after ages, and some of them are quite old, this scrub, they do collapse. But this had been a spot fire, probably a lightning strike or something like that. And I've driven past this spot between Mollerin and Corder many times, and it's a very sort of, you can see the landscape's very kind of bleak, but I tend not to always photograph midday, but this one almost deserved that contrast, that high-key bleakness, and that tree, it's very sculptural amongst this otherwise very flat horizon. And I really like this picture. It's not an easy picture, but it's definitely an important one in the context of the portraits, and also that thing about fire and what it does is such a powerful thing. That blackness is...
Yeah.
You know,
you mentioned sort of a bleakness, but it's a reminder too what it is like. Yep. Sometimes really tough being in the country.
It is. The next one is, we're into one of the town halls from the last book, nowhere near.
Well, the town halls we were sort of reflecting, reminiscing on earlier, is sort of the cultural centre of these towns.
Well, they definitely were, the whole district. This one is Nungarran, which you'd be familiar with, the town and the swimming pool by the sounds of it.
Yes.
And it's not a really dynamic exterior of a town hall. In fact, you probably wouldn't even know that it was a hall when you see it. But the interior was something else. I try not to rearrange things. I try and leave things as natural and normal as they are, because sometimes if you try and change things, you can never replicate that original aesthetic. The blue, those chairs, the arrangement of them, the tables, and behind these gold curtains. That probably actually looks a little bit more rich in the photograph than what it does in reality, were three pianos. I was told that this hall may not stay. They're desperately trying to hang on to it, but it's in bad shape.
Have they put them all on the heritage list?
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, here's your town hall.
Oh, here's my town hall.
Which is a... interior is magnificent. The exterior looks like it's had some... I don't know, maybe when you're younger it would have been the original exterior, but they've done some bad renovations of the exterior.
Well, it was just basically red brick from memory on the outside.
Yeah, but now it's an odd shape, what they've done. But this hall was quite grand in its structure. And I mean, I don't know much about architecture and form, but this original roof, the actual...
It is an interesting shape, isn't it?
Yeah, and I loved it because it's very simple, but it's very elegant. I wasn't allowed to go up on the stage because it was riddled with white ants. So I was told that to be very careful when you go in there. This was in 2020 when I photographed it. When I went back last year to do a reconnaissance, because I thought it'd be really nice to use this hall for maybe one of the performances, we couldn't go in it. It had been condemned and was a biohazard. And unfortunately, I don't think it'll be there much longer.
Well, that's the training town hall, listeners. In 1961, I remember Miles and Joan Maxwell from New Zealand stood up on that stage and played their banjos and sang ditties. And the movies during the winter we'd been there, and the summer the movies were at the back of the town hall outside. And there was dancers here. My mother put lipstick on my cheek because I went as a pirate. I'd never been more embarrassed in my life.
Brad. Did you play badminton? I mean, that was the main...
Badminton was the big thing in all of those towns halls, as we've seen.
Well, they're also very important because there's something about that structure of photograph in these places from that same viewpoint. And I did it pretty much the viewpoint you see when you enter a hall.
Yeah, it's just beautiful.
And they are, I mean, I find it's interesting because I've had some feedback from people I don't know about the exhibition, particularly the halls. They found it, at first they find them quite attractive, then some people said, oh, you know, I actually find them quite depressing because I realise what it represents is a time that's gone.
Well,
they're not necessarily of an older generation, these are young people as well. So I think they have a universal appeal about that thing about how quickly things do change.
Yeah. It is. Well, it keeps the discussion going.
The next one is...
This is really something. This could be the Opera House somewhere.
Well, it was the Opera House for 24 hours. So the Ben Cavan Hall's beautiful hall. The exterior is a beautiful hall as well. The interior is something else with that orange curtain. I wanted to photograph it before, but I couldn't because the local supermarket burnt down in 2006, and then they shifted the supermarket, was meant to be a temporary thing, into the town hall, so they still had a supermarket. So I couldn't photograph it, which was a shame because in front of the stage was a line of refrigerators, which made the whole thing quite interesting. The hall was being used, but they wouldn't let me at the time. Anyway, last year I discovered the hall was empty, and I thought, this is such a beautiful hall, and we use this for Mark Holdsworth's performance. So we brought the old upright down from the back of the stage. The shop put it in location for us on the floor, and then we brought up a grand piano from Perth for 24 hours.
My goodness.
And Mark performed for the first time this piece of music that he had written in response.
He actually
rewrote it in his head on the 3.5 hour drive up, because I was talking to somebody about some stories and he rearranged it in memory and he then played it. I don't know if you would have seen that in the performance.
Yes.
But it's quite incredible. And I must admit, in that location, that hall, when you went outside when he was rehearsing, you could hear the grand piano around town all so quiet. So it was...
It's something, isn't it? I love the way you've created this wider work of art out of it all, with the music, the composition, responding.
Yeah, because I've always wanted to almost like take that to another level. And music's such an important sort of dynamic that marriages really beautifully with imagery.
Well, I think we're going to Tokyo.
Yeah, something like that. North Bandai. So this was the hall that Emily Barker chose to do her piece in. So I first went there in 2021, went out there. I didn't even know this hall existed. I've been around that neighbourhood I don't know how many years.
You drive past North Dundee and you say, what's that? And then you've gone.
Well, yeah, I didn't even know this hall was there. So that was a surprise. And it was a surprise inside too, because the decorations were still left from years past, from when there was the neighbour had, who lived in the, now lives in the school, had their 60th birthday in there.
Oh, marvellous, isn't it?
So that was, this is just a shot I took of Emily.
And here's Emily.
When she was rehearsing before we did the recording, because we filmed it and we had a sound engineer who recorded in four channels, so this is incredible immersive experience of sound.
It's really lovely to be able to sit in that little room at the Wallula Fremantle Arts Centre and just sat in the beanbag and I stayed the distance.
Yeah, and she's an incredible performer, an artist, Emily.
It's lovely being in the West. Lovely being in the West End of Fremantle.
Well, it would have been great if we had been shown probably where there was a train station. It would have been. The last one is you would have noticed in the rooms with the video and the music.
Yes.
There was another
on the side.
So that was my video work. I did my own video in response to their performances. Then I would go off and I did in December some of my own video work in response to that to play next door. In Emily's, which was quite an emotional piece of music, I did almost like still images, but they were moving just slowly with the wind of different imagery in small towns particularly. And then I used my grandniece Nikita in a to feature with a particular part of Emily's song, where she, it's quite an emotional part of her song where it goes into this harmonica and the piano. So that was Daniel, this is Daniel's daughter, the young guy that was with the gun on the back of the ear.
Yes.
Yeah, so many years later, another generation have got involved. She lives in Darren. She's a beautiful young girl, 12 years old, and she wasn't quite sure what her was going on, but once we started filming, she held her, that beautiful thing too. And people, you can never underestimate how young people get it. A 12-year-old who was giggling, being silly, suddenly in front of the camera performed, and it was a really powerful piece. I find it very emotional.
It is, Brad. It's not dark, it's not light, it's, I mean, the colours are both, but there's something about it.
And that was just a still image off the screenshot from my
She's sort of staring straight down the lens at you.
She did, and she was kind of, because it's quite a natural, she turns away and then she sort of readjusts herself, because she's, I wasn't moving the camera, I just left it in this sort of stagnant position with her. And there were a couple of cars went past, she didn't say anything, didn't get caught up in it, she just held her poise, and she hasn't been down to the city yet to see it. I've got to try and get her down so she can see her beautiful performance. It
is something.
Yeah.
So far as the exhibition's concerned in the Arts Centre, when does it finish?
So it finishes on the 26th of April, so it's still on for a while.
So it's great. People really ought to get down there, but go down not wanting to rush is my advice.
I know, because I spoke to somebody the other day who said they thought they'd pop in for maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, thinking they'd only had the one room. Then they realised it went on, they were there for over 2 hours. And it's really lovely, because when I've been down there a few times, people don't know who I am. People do take their time. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity to be able to show the three bodies of work over 20 years worth of these projects and these books within that space, and to be seen in the same place together, and how they connect still, even though they're many years apart.
Brad, this has been a really interesting discussion for me and others listening to this, looking at these photographs. And as you say, you've been with us for some time. The Central Wheatbelt boy is never quite gone, still there. But what does the future hold?
For the me or the Wheatbelt?
Well, for both. The Wheatbelt will struggle against all of the forces of nature, which suggest it probably needed to be treated more carefully in the first place.
Well, I think people are. I think there's a generation of farmers who understand that. And I think there's, once upon a time, people were desperately aware. I think there's a generation of farmers who who are come back, who see it in a different way and understand the environmental situation. Farming practice has changed a lot. So,
photography, though, you've, as you said, some of the younger people have said, "Oh, this is an era which is you've documented and it's gone, and the training town hall is going to bite the dust." You tell me, what are the future? What does Brad Rimmer, the artist, do with what's left? Do you go back and record what's happened?
Look, when I finished Silence, I thought it was a real struggle doing that book. There was a lot going on about photographing that at the time, so I found it quite exhausting. But when I did Nature Boy and I wrote the stories, which when you get the opportunity to read, you probably then get an understanding of sort of what's behind that. So there was coming to terms with lots of things. Going back and doing the town halls was simple. It was a lovely project because there was no people involved. But then again, I didn't realise that it would take on another life. So there's always things to talk about. And I think over time, and as you get older, you see things differently. So I try and think, oh, maybe that's done, the wheat belt's finished. But I'm sure that I'll be finding something else to do. It's an ongoing project.
Brad Rimmer, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Michael.